CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney services as outstanding and excellent. Also, Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter and National Association of Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter. And finally, today we have a guest sponsor, Children's Healthcare of Atlanta.
And in this week's CFO Radio News, we have a news excerpt published from CFO Magazine. A double dip. CFOs are divided. The August 2011 survey finds that a sizable percentage of CFOs believe a second recession is imminent or, in fact, already here. CFO Magazine surveyed 300 CFOs, and on those issues, the smack in the middle of the Dow's 634 point Monday drop and 430 point Tuesday rebound. As might be expected, their opinions ran the gamut regarding whether all that volatility was a marked overreaction, something that will resolve fairly soon, or is it just symptomatic of underlying problems that will keep the markets suppressed for some time? There was more agreement when CFO Magazine asked them to frame that roller coaster ride in a broader economic context, namely, are we going to have a double dip? Recession, and is it going to happen after all? Nearly 20% of the CFOs said, in fact, we already are in another recession, and a further 23% said we're heading for one, giving the bears a near majority. The single most common response, however, was probably not, but only 11% of respondents were confident enough to give a firm no, we're not going to have a double dip. Now, whether or not CFOs see fit to toss around the R recession word, they do see plenty of cause for long-term concern. As Robert Dalio, CFO of Thomson Reuters, notes, I don't think a double-dip recession is inevitable, but I do think the bigger issue is that we face economic weaknesses at this time that we didn't face in 2008, such as a high unemployment rate, Europe's in trouble, and the government having used up many of its response options. Longer term, most Western economies need to take stock of what they can and can't afford to do. That's a very painful process, and there are structural changes underway that may take decades to work out. Now, in the heat of the moment, companies seem just unsure how to work them out. While only a handful of chiefs in the finance arena told CFO Magazine that the August plunge had sent them running back to the recession playbook, almost a third said that they had never put the playbook away, while a slightly larger number said they would stick to the current growth strategy, and a quarter said it was too soon to know exactly how they were going to respond. There was, however, one thing on which everybody could agree. Washington is at fault. More than 90% of respondents said that federal lawmakers are either extremely responsible, the choice of 71% of respondents, or moderately responsible, the choice of 23% of respondents, for the current state of economy. And on that note, let me come to a more positive topic. We have today joining us Ruth Fowler, and she is the Chief Financial Officer and Senior Vice President of Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. She joined Children's in January 2001 as the Vice President of Finance, was promoted to Chief Financial Officer in July 2002. She provides executive oversight, vision and support to corporate finance, financial planning and operations, managed care and reimbursement, information system and technology, and supply chain and treasury management. Previously, Ruth worked as Chief Financial Officer and Vice President of Finance at Rockdale Hospital and Health System. And prior to that, she also worked at Ernst & Young as a consultant and Humana Inc. as an Associate Director of Finance. Ruth graduated from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill with a bachelor's degree in business. She earned a master's degree in business from Georgia State University, and she's a CPA licensed in the state of Georgia. Well, welcome to the show, Ruth.
Thanks, Lorraine. Thanks for having me.
Real Roof, it's a pleasure to have you on board today for our radio show. What I'd like to do is to go back to the beginning of Ruth. Let's start. What was your first job and how did you arrive at your current position?
Well, as you captured, my first job was with Humana straight out of school. They had a recruiting office at Chapel Hill, and I was attracted to the opportunity, not really knowing that much about healthcare, but knowing it was a big industry, but they had a very structured program. So I started out in the healthcare for-profit arena on the hospital side. That's in the mid-80s when Humana operated a great deal of hospitals. They've now morphed into really an insurance provider. Was there and then found my way in with Ernst & Young as a consultant in their healthcare practice and really leveraged off of what I learned with Humana and financial operations. Was there for about 4 years and was actually working at a client, Rockdale, who had lost their CFO, had hired someone that ultimately decided not to come at the last minute, so they offered me the position. And I was thrilled with that. It got me off the road. And then once I was in the not-for-profit sector on the adult side, Children's was my first place where I was in pediatric health care. So I've been kind of all over the board, for-profit, consulting, not-for-profit adult, and non-for-profit pediatric. So.
Well, let me ask you, was there any previous jobs, maybe a junior CEO at the lemonade stand prior to that?
Most of my I have worked since I was 16 in one capacity or another, in either, you know, retail, or I flipped burgers at Wendy's, and probably the biggest inkling I got for running a business was my father had his own pulpwood company, and for two summers, and actually when he was sick, I would travel from Chapel Hill to Pittsburgh and help keep his small business running. So I kind of got the bug for how to run a business in a very small way from my dad. So that's probably what may have landed me in this course of action.
Well, that's fabulous. So here you are today, the CFO of Children's. Just so that the listeners can hear, I know that we're going to go into a little bit of who and what Children's Healthcare is, but essentially you had indicated that it's pediatrics. In that regard, is there, just for the uneducated, what does that mean? Up to age 18, 16? What is that?
In general, it's up to age 18. We do have some children and some of our kidney renal dialysis that will extend to age 21. And certainly when you have children with chronic diseases, many of our specialists continue to care for them in either Emory or in other locations. But in general, it's 18.
And I also understand that that may include pre-birth, while the mother potentially is having complications, or if there's a particular disease that might have been indicated with the mother of the baby.
Certainly our physicians will get into that pre-birth consultation. Children's in Atlanta right now is not into what I would call fetal surgery, which some pediatric hospitals have gotten in, which is really trying to address issues pre-birth. But our professionals are certainly serving many of the birthing hospitals and are consulting with mothers before the child is born. And then frequently, we are the place that they will come right after birth for cardiac congenital conditions or transplants or even some known issues post-birth. So it's coordinated in advance to get them here when they need to be here.
Understand. Well, let's talk a little bit about the transitions that you talked upon. Why did you take the path from consultant onto that internal role? And the reason that I ask you, many of our listeners are perhaps what we used to term in industry, in a finance role or an accounting role, and consulting and auditing are that of the outside advisor. But it's a different hat that you play.
Very much so. And I guess for me, I was well-grounded with Humana in the for-profit side, and some of the best training ground in terms of the policies and procedures and how the healthcare business side works. So having been grounded in that, my horizons were really broadened being a consultant. I was exposed to all sorts of different challenges, clients, settings and really learned a great deal. What motivated me to move back from consultant to being a CFO of a small hospital, Rockdale, two things. Personally, I had a nine-month-old son, and I had been on the road his first 9 months solid after I went back to work, so the idea of getting off the road was quite appealing. Equally appealing, though, was the opportunity to take what I had learned in a for-profit financial leadership setting and consulting and apply it in a not-for-profit setting. And it was small enough that it was kind of like my own little laboratory or petri dish. So in a place that size, you touch everything. And it was some of the most fabulous live training of applying things I had learned in different settings in a shop where I was the leader. Mm-hmm. So it was tremendous professional growth for me, as well as it met my needs personally.
And do you have any particular elements of advice for somebody that's looking at going from that outside advisor to being the CFO? Is there perhaps a little tidbit of a aha that you could pass along?
Well, you know, the nice thing about a consultant is if it's a Thursday night flight or a Friday afternoon flight, you get to leave the problems behind and they get to figure out how to make it work. So once you move from an outside advisor role to the inside, what I would say is however you handle yourself, conduct yourself, it's yours to own at the end of the day. So manage your relationships and your processes so that you really don't burn any bridges, because they'll be there Monday morning.
That's good mentorship. Well, Ruth, I know we're going to talk about healthcare reform and what we're going to refer to misaligned economics. But first, let's talk a little bit more about children's and the business model and some statistics.
Sure. Well, for those listening, assuming they may be Georgia or Atlanta-based, people may not realize how fortunate Georgia is to really have Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. Even though Atlanta is in our name, we really serve Georgia and surrounding regions. And we are among the largest providers of clinical care to a pediatric population in the country. You know, there are probably less than 60 freestanding pediatric hospitals in the country, and one is in our backyard. And that's important because while pediatric accounts for less than 10% of the total medical expenditures in the country, it's not the same thing as providing health care for adults. Having been in adult health care all my life, it's not just that kids are little adults. The staffing ratios are almost double. You have to have a much broader variety of devices. And, you know, you're taking care of everything from a 3-pound neonate up to a 190-pound, 17-year-old adolescent male. That's a really wide spectrum. We offer access to more than 30 pediatric specialties here. We're ranked among the top children's hospital by parents in U.S. News & World Report. We're a really important safety net, which people may not realize, but over half of all the births in Georgia are to moms on Medicaid, representing a particularly vulnerable population that otherwise might not have access. Those on Medicaid, which is geared towards low-income families, and the uninsured. And we work really hard to deliver on that mission and make sure that we take care of the kids in Georgia. And that translates into about $90 million annually in unreimbursed care. Fortunately, we have a very giving community. They have stepped up and continue to step up with philanthropic contributions, volunteer support. Our board of trustees is all volunteer, experts in their field who give generously of their time, and we're very blessed by the giving that is that we receive from the community at Children's, so that we can in turn continue to take care of the kids of Georgia.
And therein lies the element of you being a non-for-profit. And yeah. I believe, and one of the reasons that on CFO Radio we give one slot per month to the CFO of a nonprofit is because, you know, if you provide a particular sale or a particular product or service, typically speaking, you're going to have a relatively consistent product, customer following. You may have a recurring revenue style of business. But in the nonprofit world, you've got to keep going back and asking. And therein lies one of the challenges that I believe a nonprofit CFO has. And I would step that up a little bit by saying the second challenge that I think a nonprofit CFO has is the fact that you're organization or company's tax return is right out there for the world to see.
Yes, increasingly so. So, you know, being a not-for-profit has many more blessings than it does challenges, but it does present a unique set of challenges, not the least of which is being in the lead finance role in a not-for-profit. The primary driver is not shareholder returns, quarterly profit gains, how to make money. It's how to deliver on the mission. And so the mission always comes first, and the finances are an enabling aspect of that mission. So for those that are like what I call super core, hardcore finance, it can be it could be frustrating for the wrong type of individual in a not-for-profit role, because we are always trying to balance the need. And the needs aren't nicely bound because we're talking about kids and we're talking about human beings.
Yes, and you're talking about children's lives.
Yes. So there are some unique challenges, but it's never a dull moment, I can say that.
No, I hear. And the beauty is that Children's Healthcare of Atlanta has the ability to bring life care and attention to those that really are struggling, which I think is fabulous. Well, let's talk a little bit about, we're going to talk today about healthcare reform and misaligned economics. Before we get into that, what does that mean to you?
It means a whole lot of sleepless nights, honestly. You know, healthcare is just, it's an odd industry if you tried to stack it up against what you learn in a textbook about many industries. Everything we do is provided to the patient, who is generally not the person paying for the service. Everything we do is on credit. The typical consumer supply and demand forces don't play out so neatly in this industry. Got a lot of regulation, high fixed cost, and high barriers to entry. And as I said previously, it's not where price regulates the demand. The demand is there, and so it's about having to figure out how to meet that demand at the price point that the market's willing to pay. So,
and part of that challenge, as you said, is the misalignment, is that you've got 100% of credit, and the person that is the customer, end customer or user, some might describe, isn't the payer.
It's not, and that's actually one of the, you know, biggest facets, and so it's accentuated in pediatrics. It's not that it doesn't play out in adults, but, you know, as I mentioned, over half the births are to mom in Georgia are to moms on Medicaid. Over half of the children we serve are covered by Medicaid. It's a great program, nothing wrong with that. It's a government program, though, and so it's a public program, and in aggregate, it pays less than cost. So the economics get misaligned when you have payers that pay less than cost because it's the government, and then other payers have to pick up the difference. So you're commercially insured, and yet the ultimate person paying most of that bill is not the one receiving the care. So there's lots of misaligned incentives in terms of who's got skin in the game, who's rewarded for which activity, and how do you balance the whole set of competing interest. And, you know, there's a lot out there on healthcare reform. Great article in The New Yorker back in 2009 by Atul Gawande, which I think President Obama referenced, called The Cost Conundrum. And really right now the dynamics in healthcare are such that they're individual players and the economic rewards, not the personal rewards, are really about activity. Now, most people that go into this business do so out of the goodness of their heart because they want to take care of people, but the economics are all aligned to reward activity, not coordination of care, not paying for health and well-being. Honestly, as a provider, you get paid the sicker someone is. And in fact, most of the stuff that would keep a patient well is not even in a plan of benefit or reimbursed. So the misalignment goes across payers. It goes from individual to employer to provider. It goes across providers. It's a very fragmented system, and that can create some of the wrong results in any system that's designed like that. And I do believe that reform of the incentives, the realignment of the economic incentives, is necessary to get back to ensuring that health care is delivered, managed, and rewarded at a community level. It needs to be much less fragmented than it currently is.
And boy, am I remembering my early accounting classes when we were taught that, you know, follow this accounting pronouncement and you throw out the financial statements. You just blew all that out of the water.
Yeah, a lot in the books, textbooks, does not really apply to the healthcare industry, is what I would say.
You know, when you start out your accounting or finance career, you do truly believe that it is model-driven. On the finance side, it's, you know, economic value add or some kind of a formula. On the accounting side, it's accounting pronouncements and FASBs and, you know, soon to be maybe IFRS. But in that regard, there's almost a prescription. If I can unfortunately use the pun and use that word, but it isn't long into the career that you realize that it's an art as much as it is a science.
Completely. You know, my kids frequently say, well, what is it that you do? I say, I spend most of my time in meetings trying to get 13-year-olds to do their homework. It's not exactly true, but it's what it feels like. But there's whatever you learn in the textbook, and certainly whatever I've learned, biggest ability or skill you need to have as you venture out into the real world is flexibility, creativity, and the ability to communicate and connect at a variety of levels to understand issues, sell solutions, and then implement them. So people need to take a whole lot of communication classes in addition to those accounting and finance classes, because there's seldom a single right answer in any business setting I've ever been in.
I understand and I hear that. Well, in terms of the actual hospital's business model, we're talking about models here, specifically the nonprofit aspect of the model. We've talked about some aspects of the uninsured that you cover, but I believe at Children's you don't turn away any child. Is that correct?
That is correct, so long as we are the most appropriate place for those services. We are a not-for-profit. We are here to serve Georgia's children, and that's actually a designation in the Internal Revenue Code for healthcare facility services. Not doctors, not professional, but it means that we are exempt from many taxes, generally federal, state income taxes, most state sales taxes, so long as what we're buying is necessary to care for the patient, and most property taxes, so long as the property is deployed. The reason the IRS did that is because they believed, unlike churches, but healthcare facilities were there to provide a benefit to the community, which goes back to something that you mentioned, that in our 990 required tax returns, there's a new schedule in the revised 990s, which is really getting at measuring the community benefit that each provider provides to the community. And in 2010, we're in the process of working that up, but for the filing of that return, but we will have provided in excess of $120 million in community benefit, and the majority of that will be that $90 million I mentioned before associated with the unreimbursed cost of care associated with Medicaid and the uninsured. But that being said, that's the model, so we have an obligation to use that status to do good and to meet the community needs, and that's an explicit requirement for being exempt from taxes. We certainly, it's a bit of a joke, while it's frequently referred to as nonprofit, every business must have a margin. So we're really exempt from taxes. And so in an industry such as healthcare with high fixed costs and technologies, we need to run somewhere between a 4 to 6% operating margin just to have enough to reinvest in the plant and facilities and the programmatic development. So the words are used interchangeably, but I would say we're, you know, tax exempt, but we're definitely must create a margin.
I tend to think of nonprofits as being organizations that are for profit that just reinvest the profit into a particular mission.
That's a perfect way to say it, Lorraine. That's exactly what we do. Every dollar that we earn goes back into the programs, services, plants, and facilities that we use to take care of the children. So
how do you fund that unreimbursed expenditure? People walking the street with their hands out saying, please. And I say that jokingly, but in some regard, that is, you have a business development team out there that are looking for corporate sponsors, philanthropic individuals that could potentially donate money.
We do. We have a very active foundation that does that, and we certainly are out there spreading the message and the need for philanthropic contributions from corporate, individual, and we have many great partnerships. We also do that. I mean, this could be a bit of a misnomer, but there are many more self-pay patients that are adult than are pediatric. If you think about it, we can get a great many of the children covered under Medicaid because the program is designed essentially for pregnant women and children. So it's a wonderful safety net, and in a pediatric setting, our self-pay percentage will be probably 3%, but that's still material. But that Medicaid doesn't pay costs, so we look for philanthropic contributions to help offset that care. We do our best to get children's covered. We also try and manage the business really well. So we will seek to control our cost increases so that we're not increasing as much as the industry, which means as we have greater needs, we're just able to manage it more. And there's what I mentioned, which is what I call the payer and the product cross-subsidization. So you can't have more than 50% of your business that pays you less than cost unless you've got some portion of your business that pays you more than that. So it's a big balancing act in a lot of different venues, and it takes all of that working together to make ends meet is what I'd say.
Well, it seems to me my background for about a decade was in the telecommunications industry. And in us prepping for the show, we talked about a little bit of a parallel between where the telecommunications industry was 30 years ago and the healthcare and finance and the state of that today. Explain to us, if you can, is there a correlation here?
Well, and I believe there's some, and you having been in the industry can tell me if I am completely off base or not. But recently we were working on our long-range financial plan, and we have a board member who is from the telecom industry, and I was explaining how in healthcare it works when it because it hangs together. And so when you have, like you've had in the telecom industry, what I call cross-subsidized services and or products or even cross-subsidized payers and industries, it works when it all hangs together, either when because of deregulation in the telecom industry and or reform, the component parts start to get pulled apart and have to stand on their own, then that's a lot of change and transformation. So, and healthcare shares many other things with telecom. It's a very high fixed cost, high infrastructure, high barrier to entry, really deep technology and capability-driven industry. Not anyone can just hop into it. So that means there's a lot of regulation. It also means if you want to start breaking that thing apart, there's probably going to be some pain somewhere along the way. So the board member certainly understood when I said this works because it hangs together, and it might not if you started pulling it apart, What are your thoughts on that, Lorraine, having been in the telecom industry?
Well, some of my time in the telecom industry was from, I actually worked at WorldCom. I was part of the turnaround team there. And so that's a classic example of how it didn't hang together. And let me tell you, from the inside, it really didn't hang together. And we were able to pull it out of bankruptcy, and Verizon acquired us. But my experience is very much the same as you've described, in that I do believe certainly the regulation at the state, at the federal level, there's an awful lot of, certainly for the finance function, there's an awful lot of requirements and regulations put us put on us in the finance world through GAAP and FASB and all the elements of debits and credits and doing the right thing there. But beyond that, there are the regulations that come from the industry that essentially, once you go into either a telecommunications industry or a healthcare industry, once you've put that foot in the path, such as you have done, I think you gain deeper and broader experience in that one industry. And certainly with the depth and breadth of where you need to go and the complexities that I believe come from the regulations, it's not easy to bring somebody in and have the expectation that they understand all of those, what do I call them, dynamics. It certainly is a very complex industry.
You could not be more accurate, Lorraine, and that's actually one of the challenges. Once you're in the industry, if you're in long enough, you're in pretty deep. And I say I know a whole lot of things that no other industry would care that I know anything about. the converse is true. There are aspects of our organization where you can certainly take someone from outside the industry and put them in certain roles, either in finance or technology. But increasingly, you've got to have someone who has made the investment and commitment and has the knowledge in the industry, because it's not just about debits and credits. In fact, the very nuances of our business require that we understand stuff that's never even taught in a classroom.
You know, as you say that, Ruth, I will jump back 20-something, 24, 25 years into my early career. I had some very early on, I had some farming, agricultural clients. And at one time, I knew the cost and the value of a bull being leased for a day. And I'm kind of thinking, how do you value blood? How do you account for that kind of inventory? And my mind's beginning to boggle because I don't have any experience in the healthcare industry. But that, quite frankly, is probably one of the least of your worries. Yet, having said that, how do you value blood? I mean, a lot of the services that you provide, they're non-traditional.
They are. And blood would be one of those highly regulated products that we handle. I mean, you're going off on a tangent where there are whole divisions within the government that have to do with our oversight and handling of blood and blood products and organs, and we get surveyed. And in terms of valuing it, the cost of that is pretty much given to us because you can't go out on the market and get blood. And so then it becomes a cost pass-through. So it has less to do with how we value it, but what we can get it for and the rules under which we have to operate. So not quite as interesting as valuing a bull for stud purposes on a day, but good examples as to how nuanced many of the elements of this industry are, and you're only going to learn by being in the industry.
Sure. Very unique.
Yes.
Very unique. Well, let's discuss some of the challenges associated with you being the CFO of a mission-driven organization, and perhaps if you can step back and perhaps talk more generally about a generic CFO of a mission-driven organization. You talked a little bit earlier about some of the elements of dynamics. Are there cost-structured or hierarchical structured challenges? Is there something within the organization and the mission? Is that sort of a balance of decision making for you?
I'd say yes, in many regards. I'd also say, relative to other industries, I would say it's more about how you get things done than what you know needs to be done. The first reason that we open a service, expand a service, go into a location will be really what are we trying to serve in the needs of the community and for the children we serve. And finances are really a secondary, sometimes a tertiary or a non-existent issue. So we always have to understand the financial impact, the investments, return, if any, or negative on many of our decisions, but we don't make decisions based on finances. If that were the case, quite frankly, providing autism services at Marcus is largely a non-covered service and benefit. Even our management relationship with Grady at Hugh Spalding is a mission-driven. So first and foremost, I would say in your traditional business books, they'll say finance is one of the pillars. Certainly finance is a critical capability, but it's an enabling capability versus a driving capability. We will make decisions driven on what's in the best interest of the children. What that means as a financial leader and officer is, and I've interviewed many candidates, unfortunately, who are bright in many regards, but they believe because they say so, it shall or will be done. That is absolutely the wrong way to approach any discussion in a mission-driven organization. People have to understand that you care about the mission and them first, then what it's going to take to deliver on that, and then what they have to do operationally to execute. So it's a lot about the how, and not whether there's a right or a wrong answer.
It's interesting, Ruth, that you say that, because I'm going to take somewhat of an contrarian view, but it is by way of agreeing with you. It's something where for-profit organizations, if they had a sprinkling of pixie dust in the light of what you've just said of being mission-driven, the mission driving them really is to focus on the customer. And yes, a lot of companies, as they grow, tend to focus on the company rather than the customer. Mm-hmm. And I'm a true believer that everybody should work in retail or some customer-facing role. I'm also a true believer that every driver on the road should be on a motor bicycle so that they can actually really understand the speed and the distance and all that. But, you know, it's kind of rubber hits the road, and I use that example for that reason. If you don't truly understand who you're serving and you think that you're serving the CEO rather than serving the customer, don't get me wrong, the hierarchy and all that good stuff, but I think my experience of working with so many nonprofits has shown me that it really is all about the mission.
Not a contrarian position at all. I actually agree with you, and I never want to actually get on a motorcycle on the road for that very reason.
And hey, we might be back in hospital asking for the value of blood there.
That's right. I like the protection of my four doors. Thank you very much.
Well, as a CFO, Ruth, what keeps you up at night or gives you cause for concern?
Looking at my BlackBerry before I go to bed is the honest answer. Philosophically it's about pacing, but the real thing that keeps me up over the next 5 to 10 years is how do we as an industry take the challenge of very necessary reform, because there's a real issue with the ability of private enterprise and public to continue to support healthcare costs that are escalating at the rate that they are in this country. And that's going to require transformation. We're going to have to realign how we get paid, how we measure, what we do, and how we coordinate care. That's a lot of change. And so simply navigating through that, knowing the right things to do at the right time so that, you know, when I'm long gone, you know, 250, 500 years from now, there is still a Children's Healthcare of Atlanta serving the kids of this community, and that it somehow didn't get lost or subsumed, and kids got the short end of the stick. So it's transformation. The industry change is what keeps me up.
I hear you. Well, before we go on to our couple of final questions at the end. Ruth, I'd like to give you, if you would, a chance to be able to self-promote. On CFO Radio, we don't allow for-profit CFOs to talk too much about the product or services that they provide. But as a gesture to the community that we live in, we do that for the nonprofits. So is there a specific campaign that's currently underway at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, which might give you the opportunity to reach out to the audience listening? I'm aware somewhat of a recently launched awareness campaign to help combat childhood obesity and weight and related issues in the state of Georgia. Tell us a little bit perhaps more about that campaign.
Sure. Yeah, we have, I guess it's probably 2 weeks ago, ads started being shown in the Atlanta marketplace, really to try and raise awareness of the problem of childhood obesity. Childhood obesity has risen 300% in the last 30 years, and Georgia has the second highest childhood obesity rate in the U.S. Nearly 40% of Georgia's kids are overweight or obese. And what, aside from just being, you know, people may associate with a social stigma, it has a very real health implication for these children. Kids that are that overweight are suffering from diseases that were once only seen in adults, such as heart disease, hypertension, liver and kidney disease, and even type 2 diabetes. And when you look at today's lifestyle, being a working mom with kids, and the ease and access of quick pick-me-up foods and not the time necessarily to cook, and even what our kids are seeing is children's awareness campaign is just trying to say, hey, let's stop. Let's look at what's going on, and let's be aware that we have a problem for us, and we children certainly don't have all the solutions. We may have some ideas, but it's really about kind of waking everybody up and saying, we've got to do something collectively. And children certainly wants to be part of that. And, you know, it's kind of tough when you want to come out and claim and name an issue like the elephant in the room, but we believe it's our responsibility to at least begin the dialogue. And that's what we hope we accomplish with these awareness campaigns. And then there will be more to come, certainly. And the ads are out on TV. They're a bit like, they're a little bit confrontational, but I think effective.
I've seen some of the billboards around town, and they make you stop and listen. Read, should I say.
And that's the goal. Mm-hmm. It's not unlike, I remember a couple of years ago on the radio station, I heard a lot of the meth ads. So it's about that. It's about getting people to really engage on the issue. And if you want to see the ads or more information, we have information on our website up at www.strong4life.com, strongforlife.com.
Wonderful. And what is your main website?
Our main website is www.choa.org. O-R-G.
So, and that
CHOA
stands for Children's Healthcare of Atlanta.
Atlanta, yes. Yes.
And so if somebody would like to donate, can they go to the website, and is there a link for doing that?
Absolutely. If they go to the main website, choa.org, /give, and we would love for people to visit the website, give, if they have the inclination and or the means, and to check out some of the things that we're doing.
And perhaps also about volunteers, if somebody might like to learn about volunteer opportunities. Are there, I mean, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a healthcare physician, but could I potentially help from a volunteer perspective?
Absolutely. We do have volunteer opportunities. A lot of teens want to volunteer. That's a little bit more of a rigorous program. We've got to be very careful. But there are regular volunteers that have been in our institutions for decades. I can't give you the exact link on the website, but there are volunteer opportunities if you go on there and look.
Wonderful.
It'll put you to the right person and the right link.
Wonderful. Well, Ruth, I hate to say this, but we are nearing the end of the show, and we have a tradition on CFO Radio to ask your CFO tip of the month. What is yours?
I'm not so sure it's a CFO tip of the month as much as it may be a you know, a life tip of the month, having yesterday and over the weekend watched a lot of the coverage of 9/11 and thinking back over what's important in life. What I would say is, no matter what you may be doing or what you want to do, live, work, and lead from your core values. My mother raised me to believe, and one of her sayings was, anything worth doing is worth doing right. So I apply that every day into what I'm doing to make sure I'm doing the right thing as best I can, and to follow through so that when I'm long gone, I'm leaving, whether it's my children, my community, or my work, in a better place than I found it. So
that is a fabulous tip. And you're making me remember that my mother said that as well. And gosh, I need to keep.
Well, it breeds perfectionists, Lorraine.
There you go. It's that our mothers can turn us into somebody that ends up on the psychiatrist's table at one point. Well, thank you very much to Ruth Fowler for being our guest today. Thank you, Ruth, for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO. It's been a pleasure having you. And we would also like to thank our contributor for the news article, that of CFO Magazine. And then thanks also go to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to www.delaneyllc.com. Thanks also to Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and finance executives. Their website can be found at financialexecutives.org. And thank you to National Association of Corporate Directors, advancing exemplary board leadership for directors by directors. Their website is nacdonline.org. Well, this and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO or know of one that might like to be a guest on the show, please contact us. Thanks for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time.